The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. And they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It is the pod of thunder and rock and roll. And guess what's available for pre-order? My upcoming fourth book, No is a Four-Letter Word. And guess where you can order it? That's right, my Amazon store at amazon.com/shop/IamJericho. That's right. You can go to Amazon.com and pick it up. The book comes out on August 29th, but get your pre-order in now at Amazon.com. Go look for No is a Four-Letter Word. It's up there right now, available for pre-order. You can go check that out. And today, in continuing with part of my lineage, starting off in Stampede Wrestling in Calgary, Alberta, we're talking all about Stampede Wrestling with Ross Hart. He's the 10th out of the 12 Hart kids, the second youngest boy, right in between Brett and Owen. And of course, we would be remiss not to mention the passing of Smith Hart last week. That is the oldest of the Hart children. And Smith is also a Talk is Jericho alumni, a great guest, controversial figure, legendary character within the wrestling business. Smith left his mark, and Godspeed. Rest in peace, Smith Hart. Thanks for doing this show. And we appreciate you and wish you well wherever you might be. So Smith is gone, but Ross is here. Ross Hart, all kinds of stories about Stampede's run in the 80s. He was heavily involved in the promotion as the producer of the TV show at that time when I got into Stampede Wrestling, when I started watching. His brother Bruce was the booker, but Ross had to drive wrestlers to the shows. In fact, you're going to hear all about the scary car crash that Ross had while driving Davey Boy Smith, Chris Benoit, Sumo Hara, and Carl Moffat to a show through the Canadian Rockies. They almost plummeted to their deaths. He's also talking about Owen Hart's early days breaking into the business in Stampede. What happened when Dynamite Kid came into the promotion as the booker, and you hear when and why Stu Hart finally decided to close Stampede Wrestling. Ross Hart is on the way. But man, the Judas video, over 6 million views on YouTube, thanks to all of you who checked it out and made it go viral. Still number one on the charts in a lot of countries, including Saudi Arabia. Still top five here in the States. Let's see what's going on right now. If you haven't heard it, where you been? You're going to hear it right now. This is Judas right here on Talk is Jericho.
On the inside, you are innocence personified, and I will drag you down and sell you out. Run away. I am cold like despair.
Judas, already a live favorite, and you know we'll be playing it when we head to the UK this fall on the Judas Rising, a UK European tour starting October 27th in Birmingham, England at the O2 Academy 2, Dublin, Belfast, Chester, Manchester, London, Sheffield, Glasgow, and Newcastle in the UK. Then November 7th, we head over to Amsterdam, Aschaffenburg, Pratteln, Roncade, Rome, Vienna, Munich, Essen, Hamburg, Genk, Belgium on the 18th of November, and we're doing VIP meet and greets and mini concerts for all of those dates. You get a chance to see Fozzy up close and personal before the show even starts. So the VIP experience from Fozzy, one of the best out there. Get your tickets at FozzyRock.com. Come rock with us. All right, Ross Hart and Stampede Wrestling on the way.
Talk is Jericho.
All right, so we're here in Calgary, which is we have a WWE show this weekend, but you're talking about wrestling in Calgary. It's synonymous with the Hart family and Stampede Wrestling, and here I've got Ross Hart with me here, and you are, what number of the 12 are you?
Well, I'm actually 10th out of 12, Chris, and the 7th out of the 8 boys.
Okay, so Owen was younger than you.
That's right. I was between Brett and Owen.
Okay, oh, really? Yeah. All right. So the rest, did you have to break up fights between them? Or you like?
No, I had my share with both of them, though.
Yeah, so I mean, you're kind of stuck in the middle, right?
Exactly.
It's like fire and ice, and you're the lukewarm water.
That's right. Either way, I would lose because I couldn't beat up Brett. I would always lose to him, and if I did hurt Owen, my dad would knock the crap out of me. So
because Owen was kind of like the
Owen's 5 years younger than me, and then by the time he was about 19 or 20, I couldn't kick his ass anymore.
But I want to talk about Stampede, and more specifically, when I was growing up in Winnipeg, there were so many wrestling companies that were coming through, like on cable channels and stuff. Obviously, there was WWE, and there might have been some NWA, but there was Montreal, was Vancouver. But for me, Stampede Wrestling in about 1986 is where I really started becoming... I loved the WWE, but Stampede really started hitting home about how much I love the technique of wrestling. It was very innovative for that time frame.
Yeah, it really was. The WWF had, as it was known then, had become launched, and some of our best stars like Dynamite and Davey and Brett and Jim Neidhart had gone to WWF, but it gave the opportunity to Owen and Chris Benoit and some pretty big Japanese stars like Jushin Liger and Hirohashi, Brian Pillman, the opportunity to break in and make names for themselves, and you know, they really did, you know, and for a smaller promotion, we developed some fantastic stars, and I think it was just the work rate, and a lot of these guys had great talent and charisma, too.
Well, what was your role in the company at that point in time?
I was more behind the scenes.
Right.
I was the producer of the TV show, so I would try to edit down the show when we filmed it on Friday nights that evening because it had to air the next day. So it was almost not a live shoot, but we had about 5-6 hours, you know, to edit the show.
Wow.
Cut it down to 47 minutes with the commercial breaks, and we always were over. We always had about an hour and 10 minutes of footage because the wrestlers would go excessively long in their interviews, and some of the matches would go over. So I always had to condense it and have it ready to air the next day in Calgary and most of the major markets.
So would you have to kind of get this tape done and deliver the tape to the television studio?
Exactly, yep. And I would do it right at the global TV station where Red Whalen worked and was the TV commentator and director of sports. And we had to have it done by 8 or 9 the next morning just so they could program it and put all the commercials in. So it didn't give us a lot of time to do any fancy editing or cuts, but it was still a pretty good show when it was finished.
Well, it was a great show. It's funny because I just started. I can't remember. Somebody had a link posted online or something, and it was leading to one episode from that era. And suddenly, you go down the YouTube wormhole, and I must have watched maybe 20 of them in a row, and remembering all these great moments and stuff. But so, if you're producing the show and editing it, how are you editing the show? Because it's a weekly. Was it a weekly
live Friday night?
But so every Friday night, so you have to show a little bit of the matches, but you can't show all the matches because then people won't come to the show, right?
No, that's right.
So how do you decide what you're going to put on TV?
We had to be tactful about that, Chris. If we show too much, then people wouldn't want to come to the live shows, to see the matches. So we would usually pick up the last 7 or 8 minutes of the semis and main events, and some of the earlier matches weren't squash matches, but they were matches where the guys you're trying to build up would be put over pretty strong, but we always showed their finishes. But we seldom showed a match from start to finish because our matches were longer. We didn't have too many squash matches, so we usually pick the match up in progress and show the last 5 or 6 minutes, which was kind of abstract from all the other TV shows in wrestling where they just show squash matches for 1 or 2 minutes from start to finish, somebody getting over really strong. And our approach was always to have the matches a little more competitive or evenly matched, but still get our guys over stronger, and then show probably 4 or 5 minutes of the main event. And if it was something that was too bloody or was something that was going to involve a strap match or a ladder match or something like that.
You got a gimmick.
We would have to say that it's going to be too brutal for television. And that usually appeased Ed Whalen because he hated violence. He hated the sight of blood, and he didn't want that on there. So we usually said these matches won't be on TV, so the fans would come in droves to see
But let's talk about this because it's very interesting to me, and you just brought this up, is that you're talking – so in Calgary – being such a strong, because Stampede Wrestling was a very strong presence in the Calgary community.
That's right.
In the fabric of basically the entire city. And Ed Whalen had a lot of influence in the show, and he was the announcer of the show, but he also, you mentioned he was the head of sports.
Yeah, he was the head of sports of the Global TV Network, and that was the network that aired our
show. Did he have a lot of influence on the show? Because if he wasn't involved, you kind of might lose TV.
Yeah, absolutely. Earlier, we had lost Ed Whalen. He had quit the show because of excessive violence or what he thought were distasteful angles. And
there one in particular why he quit?
The one with Archie Goldie and Bad News Allen in 1983, where Archie Goldie's pseudo son Jeff was pile-drived on the cement floor by Kerry Brown, and Bad News Allen used the fork on Archie Goldie. And there was bedlam and chaos in the crowd. The fans were just rioting and throwing chairs in the ring. And Bad News got hit by some senior fan. I guess the fan swung his cane at him, and Bad News went and grabbed the guy and choked him, and right in front of the boxing wrestling commissioner. So
choked
an old man, and it was right on TV.
Oh, my gosh.
Cameras picked it up. Like, it's one thing the photographer shouldn't have even shown, but he did, and you could see it right there on TV the next day. But it was so intense, and Archie Goldie's interview, and it's on YouTube if you ever
watch. That's the Stomper.
The Stomper. It was so intense about his son's neck being broken. That was going to be the end of his wrestling career, and he was going after Bad News and Kerry Brown, and he was going to do whatever he had to get even and put them away because they just ended his son's career, and it was so intense, so convincing. Ed Whalen quit the show. He just it was almost too surreal for him, and he just felt the show had reached a low in violence, and it was just too over the top for Ed, and he ended up quitting, and the promotion kind of went downhill from there because
you lost TV.
We didn't lose TV, but The crowds really went down in Calgary. The commission ended up suspending my dad's license for about 3 weeks, and it was just when bad news was going to work with the Stomper. And the following Friday, there was like 2,200 fans outside the pavilion waiting to see the Stomper fight Bad News Allen. And the Boxing and Wrestling Commission very deliberately, they suspended Stu's license to promote that day just because he said his wrestlers were too out of control and there's too much violence. And and in particular, they cited Bad News for fighting outside the ring and attacking a fan. So probably what was the biggest angle, like in 10 years of the promotion, was nipped in the bud because the commission suspended Stu's license and he couldn't run in the pavilion that night. And anyway, he had to try and run on the Sarcy Reserve, which was about 40 miles out of the city at that time.
So he had to go outside of the jurisdiction of the Boxing Commission, go to the reservation, basically.
And rely on local advertising, you know. And back then, there was no social media or internet to get the fans' attention or let them know. So it pretty much killed the angle, you know. And then Bad News had to leave a few weeks after for Japan, so... But just and then Ed Whelan quit. Like he quit the promotion. So with all that negative publicity, it really was a blemish on the promotion. Like we never really recovered until Stu reopened in 1985.
Because this is after he sold it to Vince, and this has been well documented. He sold it to Vince. That's when you mentioned that Davey and Brett and the guys had gone to WWE as part of that deal.
That's right.
And then kind of reneged on the deal.
Yeah, he did. He paid my dad, I think, $25,000, and then was supposed to pay the balance of that. And Stu was supposed to get 10% of every live show in Calgary.
And the total was supposed to be like $1 million or something?
I thought it was supposed to be $500,000.
Oh, so he paid $25,000?
Yeah. And he never paid anything to Stu beyond that. And Stu had helped him get TV in all the major markets in Calgary, Edmonton, Vancouver, Winnipeg, all our markets, Saskatoon, Regina. Sold him his rings, and they had about five or six of our rings, and basically access to some of the best talent in the world, you know.
So, sure.
But in any case, when they first tried running here in 1984, they fell flat. The WWF sort of before Hulkamania had really caught on, you know, and it was sort of a delayed reaction in Canada. And they had the Maple Leaf. I think you probably remember the Maple Leaf TV shows.
Billy Red Lions.
Yeah, with Billy Red Lions. I think they filmed them out of Hamilton. You know, basically just squash matches. The fans didn't buy that very much. You know, they didn't want to see just one-sided squash matches. And even though there were great stars, there weren't any competitive matches on TV. So for the first year, they fell flat here. I remember they brought in Andre the Giant and Angelo Mosca and sent some pretty big names, and they were drawing under 2,000 fans in the Saddle Dome.
Wow.
And they finally stopped running after about 6 months, and Vince basically encouraged Stu to start the promotion up again and revive some local interest in it, but he reneged on his payments, you know. So
what made you guys decide to open up again in 85?
I think, my dad wasn't very happy with the WWF product, so they came here and ran about six times over 8 months, and the crowds just got smaller and smaller, and, I think he just felt that the local fans in Calgary and Edmonton deserved something better, and would really support the concept of live wrestling again, weekly shows again. And he approached Ed Whelan again and, you know, reassured Ed that, we would minimize the level of violence and blood that was shown on TV. And that appeased Ed when Ed was back on board to commentate the show. And really, there was nobody but Ed to do it.
Was it hard to get Ed to come back?
It was, you know.
What convinced him to come back?
Oh, I think
the cash.
I think the cash for sure, and but some pretty strong guidelines that there wouldn't be violence, it wouldn't be blood, you know. And Ed always had problems with that, but we had to tame the show down considerably.
Well, and also too, and here's another thing from watching some of those episodes that I mentioned to you, watching about 15, 20 of them. Ed would freely get involved if he felt the heel was out of line. He would get up and like just walk in the ring, push a heel, grab a chair. Like he was like, if a Michael Cole tried this or you know, like Corey Graves or somebody in the WWE now, you would get fired, you would get your ass kicked. But Ed had this kind of free reign to do whatever the hell he wanted, right?
He did, and he was a totally baby-faced commentator.
Yeah.
So if he saw skullduggery. If he saw John Foley interfere,
Bob Brown,
or Bob Brown, yeah, or somebody, he would jump in the ring and he would go after that heel. You know, and sometimes he just couldn't control his emotions. Quite often, Ed was, he kind of knew what the finish was for the television side of it, but he really didn't know what would lead up to that, or the intricacies of the interference, or the
sure,
or the foul play, and he would react, you know, in a babyface fashion, you know, and sometimes
so that was
that,
for real. It was a
oh
shoot.
Yeah, quite well, pretty much, yeah, yeah. You know, and because he was a voice for the people.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
So he's very unique in that sense as a commentator. You know, he was the people's commentator. So, but when he agreed to come back and host the show again, my dad started back and 1985, so it was about a year layoff, and you know, it gave us a chance to really launch some new stars like Chris Benoit, like Owen, like Brian Pillman.
You had an amazing roster. You mentioned, yeah, Pillman and Owen and Benoit, huge stars, but you also had guys like Blackman, Beef Wellington, Johnny Smith. Awesome. And here's another guy I think is very underrated. We'll talk about all those guys, but watching Mike Shaw, Muck and Singh, probably like a very regional heel in that he's a territory heel. He couldn't take that act to WWF, most likely. But in this world, in this territory, he was an unbelievable heel. You hated that guy.
Yeah, absolutely. His real gift was his microphone ability. He did some of the best interviews, the best promos.
Yeah.
He was just like a big bully. He would cut down the people. He would cut down the fans, basically just say, you know, they're minimum wagers, you know, that hate him because he's successful and he's got everything it takes.
Meanwhile, he's a big fat kind, yeah, of balding guy.
There you go.
If you hadn't seen him, if you haven't seen this guy, and they would chant at him, toilet bowl.
Yeah, and I mean, that was great because he reacted that and hated that. You know, it got over great, and they sold lots of pictures too. So
I actually took a couple on this character I'm doing right now. I was talking to Vince about it probably 3-4 months ago, right when I was in the midst of watching this stuff, and we were talking about it, and I was like, you know, I've been watching Stampede Wrestling, and this Mike Shaw, Muck and Singh, I took some of his traits as a regional heel, but took it to a national, worldwide territory like WWE, and no one uses those little tricks.
Yeah.
But he had them, you know, and it was such a great heat getter, but you would never understand it unless you were actually here watching in Calgary.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, because he was large, he was oversized, he was obnoxious, and that was kind of his personality sometimes too.
Yeah.
If he rubbed Mike the wrong way, you know, he could be pretty quarrelsome, pretty irritable, but he loved working with my brother Owen, loved
great
Bruce
matches.
Whatever Bruce told him to do, he did. I think Bruce deserves a lot of credit for molding and guiding Mike, because he had been here previously just as Mike Shaw and really never got over that grade. He was kind of a mid-card performer, but when we transformed him into Muck and Singh and had him join the Karachi Vice with Gamma Singh, you know, who was probably the most hated heel in the territory, you know. And
let's talk about the Karachi Vice.
Yeah.
It was
that's what really got Mucking over, though, and you know, so we had no longer Mike Shaw. It was Muck and Singh, and
he was with
Gamma Singh
yeah,
and then
Abu Wizal,
and then they made Gary Albright Vulcan Singh.
He was Vulcan Singh, yeah.
Yeah. So and it was great. It was kind of the heel faction.
It was like a Pakistani,
yeah,
heel faction.
Yeah, and it was interesting. Gamma was really just a Sikh East Indian. Had been a kind of an undercard babyface for years, but when we turned him into a villainous Pakistani heel, you know, it got over great, you know, and he played the role well. Muck and Singh just added that. That element to it, just a bigger, heavier, bullish right, heel that always cheated to win and was completely obnoxious and disrespectful and rude to everybody.
You had two white guys masquerading as East,
yeah,
Indians.
That's right.
And that was the heat. And then you had Abu Wazal,
yeah,
who I'm not sure. I think he was probably East Indian.
Yeah, he's Lebanese. Yeah. Yeah.
Lebanese.
Yeah.
So, but he would just kind of go in there and speak gibberish, this little, like, you know, Weasel.
Yeah.
Weasel. Get it, guys?
Yeah.
So it was like this great heel faction where if you needed a team, a heel to win, he had all these guys to help him.
Absolutely.
Cheat to win. So it was perfect, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah, it was. And, it, you know, Muck and I think deserves a lot of credit for launching Owen's career because he, whatever Owen did, he was able to sell and catch Owen for, you know, like it was the hardest I'd ever seen him work. And, you know, Owen had some incredible matches, but if it wasn't for Muck and Singh getting him over as a babyface, I think it would have taken him longer to get established and launched. But, they, you know, and they had a great feud for like 3-4 years, you know, before Owen went to the WWF.
And the thing is, too, so it was about 86. I'll never forget the video. It was Hearts on Fire. It's a Bryan Adams tune.
That's right.
And you guys had done like a highlight package of this Owen Hart. And I'd never seen this before. I was a WWF fan. I loved Savage and Steamboat and the Rockers and those type of guys. But I'd never seen the moves that Owen Hart was doing. And that was which basically convinced me that I wanted to get into wrestling.
Wow.
And most of the stuff Owen was doing, the base for that stuff was Muck and Sing.
Yeah,
and it was absolutely all of this lucha type stuff and acrobatics and all this really cool stuff. I'd never seen it before. And it was introduced to me via Stampede Wrestling.
Yeah, it really was. And, you know, it put both of them at a whole new level, you know. Mm-hmm. But and it was amazing to see, you know, Muck and Sing was probably 350 pounds. And, you know, Owen was able to do his leapfrogs and his...
We used to call it the bum flip. He'd grab his hand, jump on the top rope, bounce on his ass, and flip over.
Yeah, and you know, and do the backflips and all those things. And you know, it was well crafted. It really was, but it was great.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed, also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Talk is Jericho.
So let me ask you this. So you're involved as the producer of the show. And was Bruce the booker?
Bruce was the booker for the most part. You know, he was... booker basically right up until about the end of 1988 when Dynamite Kid had left the WWF and he came in and took the book for about 6 months, which didn't go very well. Mm-hmm. But Bruce, for the most part, was the booker for that whole time period.
And what was Stu's involvement?
Figurehead. Or? He was a promoter, you know, and sometimes when he wasn't happy with the angles, he just said, all I do is sign the goddamn checks, you know. But, you know, at times, he didn't approve of Bruce's ideas. He thought they were over the top or, you know, had gone too far. And I think he was a little bit wary of Bruce, especially after the Bad News Stomper incident. And Bruce got a lot of... blame for that, and he really shouldn't have. It was just a lot of things that were sort of out of his control, and I mean, it just got over so great. It was just so intense, but it got that reaction from the fans and the media and Ed Whalen, of course. But so Stu was always kind of an unwilling promoter with Bruce booking, but Bruce deserved a lot of credit. He helped get a lot of guys over. He sure knew did. How to get baby faces over because they would get screwed by the heels. You know, they would get so much sympathy because they had been screwed by John Foley or Abu Izzal or the Karachi Vice, and then, you know, finally they would get some kind of payback or revenge, and it all got over very well in the end. But you know, Bruce, I thought, deserved a lot of credit because he had some very innovative angles.
Well, and not only that, you talk about, you know how to get guys over. I think we've already mentioned half a dozen guys that went on to get, you know, become national stars in WCW or WWF, WWE. But when you're talking about, I'll throw you some names. You can kind of give me some background. So you're talking about Owen in 86. That was basically his pro debut, was in Stampede, or had he gone other places by the time he was in Stampede?
No, you know, it's interesting. He'd worked under a mask on some spot shows, and, you know, so he didn't blow his alias, his own heart. And in fact, I think he had one of his first matches in Winnipeg in 1986. We ran jointly with Tony Condello for a couple of shows in Winnipeg and Brandon, and kind of a disaster. They didn't draw too well, and I think Tony shorted us on the gate quite a bit.
But, of course he did.
Yeah. But Owen actually worked on quite a few of the spot shows and waited until, you know, he was ready to make his TV debut. And then I remember in 86, Bruce had blown his knee, tore his ACL in a tag match, and we had to put Owen in Bruce's spot right away just because Bruce was injured and out of action. And just because Owen had worked for 4 or 5 weeks just doing some spot shows and working under a mask, you know, he was ready. And, you know, he was... he was green, but he had some really good guys to work with. You know, some veterans like Kerry Brown and Duke Myers, and then when he and Ben Bastrab worked with the Viet Cong Express, which was Hiro Hase and another Japanese guy named Fumihiro Nakura. You know, there were just some great matches, and Owen was just such a fast learner. But
was he a tape watcher because he's doing stuff, or was he just innovative? Because I had never seen that stuff either. He stole it from other countries, or he just came up with this stuff on his own.
I think he had watched a lot of Tiger Mask, the original Tiger Mask, in Japan, and I remember though when he wanted to do the backflip off the top ropes. You know, I think the only one who I'd ever seen do that was Edouard Carpentier, which was probably like about 20 years before that. And Owen just decided to do it. We had the ring set up in our backyard. And I think Phil LaFon or Phil LaFleur had tried it once or twice, but, you know, he never got the height or the great landing. But Phil could certainly do it, but he never really did it too often, you know, and I think he was just afraid he might land wrong, or, you know, he'd look bad and be embarrassed. So Owen just said, I'm going to try it, got in the ring and had a couple of spotters the first few times, and then after that he just had it down pat. So he used to do the backflip off the top rope, and then the other one where he, you know, did the... where the guy would hold his wrist and he'd leap on the ropes and backflip off and then do a hip toss. So, a lot of those were his own, but he was definitely inspired by some of the high flyers.
So he's obviously a natural, though, because he's coming into his dad's, his family's promotion. There's a lot of pressure on him as Hart. You have that last name of Hart. That's a lot of pressure in Calgary and a lot of expectations. And so you're saying he came in pretty much off the bat and made a big mark for himself. So he must have been a natural.
Yeah, he was, you know, and he'd wrestled a lot as an amateur. Like, he was wrestling for the UFC Dinos at the time, and Stu had high hopes that he would maybe go for the Nationals or something like that. But when things fell into place with professional wrestling, and he got over so well, and again, it was filling that void that had been left not only by Brett, you know, who was in the WWF by that time, but Bruce and Keith, who were aging, you know, and still wrestling, but you know, not the young heartthrobs they once were, and even Dynamite and Davey, who had left the promotion, while Owen just sort of filled that void, and he got over so well, he never really did go back to university and get his teaching degree or pursue the amateur wrestling, but you know, the opportunities were there, and he made some great money and had the opportunity to go to Japan and Mexico and Germany and all these places to travel, and of course the WWF.
Sure. In the meantime,
yeah.
So let's talk about a young Chris Benoit who the first time I ever saw him, obviously, was in Stampede. Fan of his right off the bat. And did he just show up one day? Was he a fan? How did he get involved in Stampede Wrestling?
Yeah, it was interesting. He just showed up one day. Couple of guys that used to help us run the promotion in Edmonton, and it was Bob and Mike Bulat, and their dad had been sort of a co-promoter with Stu, and they brought Chris down and said Mike Hammer had been training him in Edmonton, and Mike was a really good teacher. He was kind of a degenerate in other ways, but he was actually a pretty good teacher, really knew how to wrestle well, and was kind of a quiet, understated type, but he took Chris under his wing, and I just basically taught him rope work and basics, but you know, I don't think they even had a ring to use, probably just a mat somewhere up in Edmonton, but he obviously spotted something there, you know, that Chris just had a natural talent. And I remember Chris used to come to the shows in Edmonton. He'd show up there, and he idolized Dynamite Kid, and I remember he was just probably about 14 or 15 years old, and he was very quiet, very shy, and we'd come to the matches every Saturday in Edmonton, but he was too shy to you know, asked if he could meet any of the wrestlers, and everything was very kayfabe-ish back then. We never let fans get too close to any of the wrestlers, but I remember him coming to the matches, and he just seemed to be a very dedicated fan, and he obviously was inspired by Dynamite. And when Mike Hammer broke him in, it was sort of during that period just before we started Stampede again in 1985. Mike Hammer had taught him enough just to show him the basics, and he was probably about 180, 190 pounds, but had a great physique. You know, he was right lifting weights already, and they brought him down, and Bruce and I were working out with some other guys, and they said, well, let's see what Chris can do in the ring, and you know, he just had that natural flair. You know, he was just a fast learner, and again, he had that start, and then he started working out with us at our house and with some other wrestlers. And Bruce knew he could get over very well. And we needed some new young heartthrobs and some new baby faces. And he just sort of fit that spot. And at that time, Chris was really polite and respectful. You know, I always found him to be that way, but he never asked for too much. He always appreciated whatever you showed him. And, you know, he wasn't wanting a lot of money. He just wanted the opportunity to break in and get that experience. I think he would have taken anything we could have offered him.
Sure.
So he stayed at our house for about a month, and that gave him the opportunity to work out in the dungeon and use our weights. And when we started the promotion up, you know, we just said, let's see how he gets over. And he actually broke in before Owen, about 5-6 months before Owen, and was a well-established babyface. But, you know, he was just one of those natural talents that came to us.
So what would a guy like, you know, a starting guy like Chris, or you're talking like a Beef Wellington or guys like that, what would they be getting a week? Would they be getting 400 a week, 500 a week?
Yeah, I think they started out probably making about 400, and then when they were elevated or if they won a title, they were probably making closer to 500.
Okay.
Yeah, I think Chris was making 500 pretty steadily, which wasn't great money, but it was steady. He was making that every week. And
not for a young guy, getting a chance to live your dream, it's
absolutely
not too bad, right?
Yeah, and then he started getting exposure in Japan, Mexico, and some places, you know. So with a lot of these guys, there were the opportunities to go to Mexico or Japan. A lot of them, of course, were thinking about the WWF, but for the majority of them, you know, it would have been too soon for him. You know,
sure.
They wouldn't have had quite the look or the seasoning.
Thing about Stampede, though, is it was such a great combination of, okay, American style, English style, Mexican style, Japanese style, European style.
Sure.
It was a real mix. So you said that's why so many of the guys went and could go somewhere. Like for take a guy like Johnny Smith. Nobody in the States really knows him. But in Japan, he had a very long, successful career.
Right.
Because he basically, I mean, he broke in England, but he kind of earned his stripes here in Calgary, learning
right.
how to work. You know?
And I think a lot of these guys were truly international workers. They could go just about anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they could adapt to the Lucha Libre style pretty fast in Mexico. They could work the round style in England, and then get booked in Germany and Austria, you know, and places that you
sure.
probably worked.
Yeah.
And then, you know, if they were lucky, they would get booked with New Japan or All Japan, one of the major offices. You know, and if they did well in their first tour, you know, they're always brought back, and they had the chance to make really big money and get that exposure.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Was there some guys that worked through here that you thought were really good that didn't get as much of didn't get as high up the ladder as you thought they might have? Underrated, I guess would be the right word to say.
Yeah, there might have been a few. You know, Hiro Hase did really well with us, but I wish he had stayed here longer. But at that time, there was kind of a power play in Japan with All Japan and New Japan, and his faction, I guess, with Riki Choshu's group had gone back to New Japan. So you know, he was getting over very well with us. We just turned him babyface and unmasked him as the Viet Cong Express, and then he went back to Japan there. And I think if he had stayed here another year or two, he would have been more polished, more seasoned.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, so I just didn't think he reached his fullest potential. And Kichi Yamada, Jushin Liger was another one, but when he came to us, he was here for about 4 months, 5 months, and then New Japan just decided they needed him back. Somebody else was injured, and they needed him for their cruiserweight or junior heavyweight division.
Yeah.
And you know, so it was kind of our loss because you know, he was getting over very well, but That was business sometimes. Sometimes it was out of our control.
You would get guys that would come in that you would hope to keep for 6 months or a year, but like a hockey team, they'd get called up from the minors to the majors.
Exactly, and that's who they work for. I mean, with the Japanese office especially, I mean, they had no control or say. You know, if they were called on a week's notice, they had to go back and leave whatever they were doing with us here. So there were a few there that I didn't think reached their fullest potential, but while they're here, they had a huge impact on the territory.
And did you have relationships with Japan where they would call you and say, "We have a guy we want to send you," or was it just kind of a random thing? Or
it was kind of a random thing. Mm. You know, we had a really good booking arrangement with New Japan, and they were booking a lot of our top guys, including Dynamite and Davey, Brett and Bruce and Keith, because we were using guys like the Cobra and I think it was Hiro Saito and Shunji Takano and a whole bunch of them, especially during the popularity of the junior heavyweight division. And then when Dynamite and Davey switched and left New Japan for All Japan just before a tour had started, which was pretty major news in 1984, and my dad really wasn't aware of, you know, they kind of excluded Stu so he wouldn't be implicated in what they were doing, because it was pretty major news, because it was right before their tag team tournament, and they were booked for New Japan, and then just before the tour started, they show up at a press conference and announce they're working for All Japan.
It was a big deal, a major coup,
you know, and the fallout, unfortunately, was New Japan felt Stu either was oblivious to it or was aware of it and didn't try to do anything to stop it, and so they didn't really book guys directly through us, which was unfortunate. So Tokyo Joe or Joe Daigo, I don't know if you knew him, but he was the agent after that, and he pretty much would just sort of individually book guys on their own, and we could have interceded and said, you know, we want a commission or some kind of an agent's fee if you're booking guys like that, but we didn't really.
We
could have. I mean, just because a lot of these guys were working in our promotion, and we could have maybe used a little more leverage and say, we want you to book some other guys, because primarily they seem to be interested in Owen and Chris, you know, and then later Brian Pillman and a few others, and I think Bad News Allen had some influence there as well. He got a few guys booked. He initially got Chris booked in Japan, but we just didn't interfere with that. We just thought if the wrestlers had the opportunity to go to Japan or Germany, you know, we wouldn't get involved seek any remuneration. We just wanted the wrestlers to have that opportunity, and so we kind of stepped aside there, but. Probably we should have been a little more assertive.
It's kind of the way it was back in those days.
Yeah, it was.
I remember one of my first tours in Japan, I worked with a guy called Super Strong Machine. And talking to him, he was here as, what was his gimmick?
Yeah, Sunny Two Rivers.
Yeah, he was a Japanese guy playing an Indian.
Yeah,
like that's a First
right.
Nation
that was
Indian.
That's one of Bruce's roles, you know. It was amazing because we had too many Japanese in the promotion at the time, way too many. So we were giving all of these guys different aliases. We said Hiro Saito was from Malaysia, Shunji Takano was from Cambodia, and they're all Japanese. And then with Junji Harada, we decided to make him an Indian, and we shaved his head, and he had the Mohawk cut, and called him Sunny Two Rivers, and it was great. You know, it's probably not very
politically correct.
No,
right?
with the First Nations people, but in a lot of the spot shows, they didn't seem to really notice the difference. And you know, and he was a good hand, but
he was, yeah.
But you know, we had to kind of improvise with a lot of those roles. Otherwise, they all look the same. Just they're all Japanese. But and a lot of these guys took advantage of the opportunity. If they're asked to wear a mask or shave their head or do something a little outrageous, but it got them over, and they had the chance to get some exposure. And then their offices in Japan would see, hey, these guys are getting over in Calgary, and we'll bring them back and make them big stars. So it was a win-win situation for us and the wrestlers.
Tell me about and I always heard rumors about this, and maybe you can kind of fill me in about so Jason the Terrible was here. He was kind of doing a Friday the 13th hockey mask heel, and his manager was the Zodiac.
That's right.
Who always talked like he had like a computer voice. I am the Zodiac. Masked guy. What was the story behind that?
Well, and I don't know if you knew the real person who was the Zodiac was Barry Orton, Randy's
uncle, right?
Yeah, Randy, yeah. You know, Bob Jr.'s younger brother, but When Barry came in, he'd approached Bruce about doing this role as the Zodiac and wearing the mask, and he would make these references to astrological signs and influences and Lucifer, and you know, he was incredible on the mic. He did some of the most powerful interviews that I've ever seen, but he we'd cut these interviews just in the TV studio on Friday nights, and they would just sort of add some special effects, some laser lights, and this black background. But he did the interviews, and it was incredible. And that's really what helped Carl get over, because he didn't speak. He was just sort of this
juice
and
I don't even know if this is true or not. But was he in trouble in the States, and he came here like to kind of hide out, and that's why he was wearing a mask and had the voice thing?
He was in trouble. Unfortunately, he'd been in a car accident in the States, and it was actually when he was working, I think, for the WWF, and he'd been charged with vehicular manslaughter.
Oh.
He was driving with an underage girl and had a car crash, and she was killed, and she was underaged. And anyway, so his court trial was pending, and he didn't know what was going to happen, if he's going to be convicted or not, and he was. He got a 2-year sentence. But in the meantime, he came here and worked for my dad, and he and Bruce collaborated on this idea of him being the Zodiac, because Jason needed a manager,
right.
He needed a mouthpiece, and it was incredible. And that was something that I wished we could have run for a couple of years, because we were selling out. We were doing incredible business, and then when he had to go back for his trial, we had to cut it short.
And
we ended up having him turn on Jason after they lost a tag team match to Bruce and Pillman, and they built it up for them to have this one match. And we could have gone with that for months and months, or just had them as this indestructible force.
Sure.
It was amazing how much they were over, you know, and you know, we had to cut it short, you know, but it was just one of the innovative things that got over in the promotion.
How was business then at that time frame, 86 to 88?
You know, up and down, but that particular gimmick was really getting over.
So Jason and Zodiac got over. What were some other money makers for you at that time frame?
Well, certainly the Karachi Vice, you know, the Bruce and Pillman working as Bad Company. They had a run for like over a year as tag team champions, and it was great because Brian was an incredible athlete. You know, what an athlete he was, and you know, a great talker, and you know, and for Bruce, it rejuvenated him. You know, Bruce had come back from a knee injury, and you know, and Bruce was pretty unselfish in the sense he didn't want to tag team with Owen and look like he was the older brother trying to ride on Owen's coattails. So he said, let's just push Owen in singles because he's getting over great, and I'll tag team with Brian. And Bruce was mentoring and tag teaming with Brian, and it got over great, you know, for them. And so I think there was some drawing power there as well. Mm-hmm. And occasionally Davey Boy and Dynamite would come in and do some shots.
I remember
with us.
This one time, maybe it was the summer of 86, 87, when Brett, and maybe Jim too, but it was almost like the Hart Foundation versus the Bulldogs, but in Stampede Wrestling.
It was. It was actually Brett against Davey and some singles.
Right.
I mean, if we could have run a tag series, we would have, but...
So Vince is lending you these guys?
Vince kind of gave his permission, and that was only because Davey was still living in Calgary at the time, and Brett was, and I don't think WWE was thrilled with it, because I think they thought that it was taking away from what they were doing on their TV, and mm-hmm. at the time, the Hart Foundation won the title from the Bulldogs, and then Dynamite had his back injury, and he was out of action for a few months, and... so his wrestling was pretty limited at that stage, but basically Brett and Davey got the okay or permission to do a singles program here for about 2 weekends when they had some time off from WWF, and it was incredible because it was you know, it was an extension of the tag rivalry they had there, and
did that draw good for you guys?
It worked huge. They sold out the pavilion the first week, and then they did like a chain match the second week, and Brett was a heel and Davey was the baby face, and it was incredible. I remember there was a double main event where Owen worked with Muck and Singh, and Brett worked with Davey Boy, and that place was just packed. You know, and the crowd was just electric. So,
what was the capacity of the pavilion?
About 2,000.
Yeah.
At that time,
and that was your weekly Friday night building.
Yeah. Yep.
So where else did you go throughout the course of the week?
So we'd run Edmonton every Saturday.
Okay.
And we used to have the sales pavilion, and then before the replaced that with the AgriCom, which was a smaller center, but still a really good atmosphere for wrestling. And then we'd run Regina and Saskatoon, usually every Monday and Tuesday, and then a whole bunch of different cities like Red Deer, Lethbridge, Medicine Hat. Medicine Hat was one of our best towns, and Swift Current, Moose Jaw. We were running all sorts of spot shows on Indian reservations, hockey arenas, some places like way up in northern Saskatchewan or BC, but incredibly, that's where we're drawing some of our biggest crowds, because those are places where the WWF would never run, and they never had any opportunity to see live wrestling but Stampede. So quite often we'd get our best crowds in some of those smaller places, you know, Okanagan, BC, Montana, you know, and because the TV was over so strong, you know, we were drawing huge crowds, whereas, you know, Calgary is a little tougher now because we were competing with the WWF. We were competing with the Flames, and that
it's
year
a weekly
they went
show.
Yeah, and you know, the Stampeders, and a lot more sports entertainment, and so sometimes it was tougher to draw in Calgary and Edmonton than the smaller spot shows.
So let's talk about like financials. So if you're doing these five or six shows a week, was it seven shows a week?
Oh, quite often six or seven, minimum six.
So what
shows, sometimes seven.
What would you have to make on a week to keep the territory going? Would you have to say, we got to make 10 grand a week, we got to make 20 grand a week? I mean, was there a certain number that you had to hit on, or was it more of a monthly thing?
No, you know, and to be honest, I knew my parents were losing money, you know, by the time they were paying for TV production and vans, you know, to transport the wrestlers, and you know, gas at the time, and you know, and they always paid guarantees, like even if the gates were small.
You never heard people getting ripped off
no,
in Calgary.
No, yeah. You know, you really didn't, you know. Mm. You know, unfortunately, during that 4-year period, it was a losing proposition in most weeks. Although we had some incredible crowds, you know, sometimes we were drawing 1,100, 1,200, you know, which was pretty big. And you know, Peace River or Grand Prairie, you know, but
huge crowds.
Yeah, which were great. But the overall expenses were pretty tough.
Dragging
and you know, we were losing money, and we stuck with it until the end of 1989. And by that time, the WWF was running more often, and they'd taken so many of our best stars. Like Owen had finally gone there, and Chris Benoit was working in Japan.
Pillman was in WCW. Muckin Singh was in WCW.
We had lost our core of our best stars, and it was pretty tough, you know. So
sure.
At that stage, it just wasn't viable to keep running.
But let's talk. You're mentioning, and then there's a famous story that I want you to tell me about all the travel that you're doing. You're driving everywhere.
Yeah.
I was actually, my very first taste of the wrestling business, I was on the ring crew for Bob Holliday in Winnipeg in the summer of '89. And we heard through the grapevine, and once again, there's no social media, there's nothing, that there had been a very serious accident in Calgary, the Calgary territory, and you were involved in that.
Yeah, I was the driver.
You were the driver. So tell us about this, horrible story.
We were on our way to, just trying to remember now if it was northern BC. I think at the time we were driving through Jasper, though, and it was in July, and I had about seven wrestlers with me, and I was driving. And
in a van?
In a van. It was a rented van, a budget van. And
who was in the van, do you remember?
Davey Boy was in the front seat, and behind me were Chris Benoit and Kitahara or Sumo Hara, who wrestled for All Japan, and Carl Moffat was in the back.
Jason the Terrible.
Yeah. And anyway, we were late. We were late leaving Calgary. We were about an hour and a half late because several wrestlers didn't show up, or they just decided they weren't going to work. And we were at the Mohawk gas station waiting for some of these wrestlers to show up. I remember Dynamite Kid didn't show up, and I said, how are we going to run these shows with two of our major stars?
You're at the Mohawk in Calgary, and everyone's supposed to meet you guys, and then you get in the van and go.
Yeah, and so...
So guys just wouldn't show up?
Yeah, I remember Dynamite Kid had boycotted the trip. He decided he wasn't going to go. He had had an incident where he had attacked my brother Bruce in High Level the week before, and... you know, and Bruce's jaw was broken, and there was a lot of bad blood with him and
Dynamite broke
the
Bruce's jaw.
Yeah, you know, it was an unfortunate thing that happened, and anyway, he basically decided he wasn't going to work on the tour, and he and Davey were headlining in the main event, you know. So anyway, we were about an hour and a half late, and we were driving toward Jasper, and I was driving to make up time, and I hydroplaned on an icy section, and I was trying to steer the van back in my lane, and it just went straight, and we had a head-on collision with a station wagon that had a trailer, and
oh my gosh, yeah. Are you on like on a mountain road?
Yeah, on a mountain road, and it was a sharp curve. You know, like this was summertime, but it was in the mountains, so the roads were icy, and there was no warning of that whatsoever, you know. And speed certainly was a factor in the accident, you know.
Sure.
For sure, you know. It was, at the time I was probably driving 90 kilometers an hour and speed limit was 80, you know.
Yeah,
but
bad,
with the
yeah.
ice conditions, you know, that just made it worse. So we had this major collision, and Davey Boy wasn't wearing a seatbelt. You know, I remember I'd told Davey earlier in the trips that you should be wearing your seatbelt. At that time, it wasn't against the law not to wear seatbelts. I think Alberta was the last province to hold out on that. And Davey, you know, and that's just the way he was. He said, no, I'm not wearing a seatbelt, and he didn't. And so I was wearing a seatbelt, and, you know, if I hadn't been, I would have been probably thrown right through the windshield. But as it turned out, Davey went forward and hit his face right against the dashboard. Oof. Hit his head, and, you know, he had to get about 60, 70 stitches in his forehead. And Carl Moffat, who was sitting in the back, he'd been smoking a joint and was pretty much passed out for the whole trip. He was lying in the back seat, and the spare tire was flung forward and hit him right in the leg from behind, and had broken his leg. So
basically shattered it, right?
Yeah.
I remember he wore a brace for years.
Yeah.
Even when I started wrestling in 91, 92 out here.
That's
he
right.
Still messed up.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, and that was unfortunate, and minor injuries too.
You have the head-on collision, and then you, like, you're on the side of the road, no
yeah.
cell phones.
No cell
How
phones,
you
know, and then checking on the passengers, you know, and, you know, you're in kind of a state of shock, right? I mean, and, you know, thank God nobody was fatally killed, you know,
right.
from our vehicle or the other vehicle. The driver of the other vehicle was pretty seriously injured. I think he had ruptured his femur, and he had to be hospitalized. And, you know, I'm just thankful there weren't any fatalities.
Did you get any injuries?
No. I mean, I think my back was out, my shoulder. But it was more just the shock of what had happened, you know. So
do you guys still go to the show after?
Well, no. The whole tour had to be canceled.
Oh, gotcha.
which was really unfortunate. And, I mean, we had solid crowds. I think it was in Grand Prairie, and that was like the first leg of the tour, and then we were supposed to run a whole bunch of cities in northern Alberta, and because three or four wrestlers had been injured, you know, we just had to cancel the whole tour. So it was, you know, an unfortunate thing.
Did that ever happen, like, especially in the wintertime, if you're driving in February or March, the van ever break down anywhere,
Many times. Bruce had been in a major accident, but that was back in 1981. He had Mr. Hedo and Jerry Morrow, Jim Neidhart, and this ring crew guy named Kevin. And Bruce was driving my dad's Seville Cadillac, and they were driving to Lethbridge, and it was about minus 35 weather, and they were driving down Highway 2 south, and it used to be just a divided highway back then. And he was going southbound, and this semi-trailer all of a sudden decided to turn left in a south direction and turn right in the direction of Bruce's vehicle. And Bruce knew he couldn't stop. You know, there's no way he could stop to avoid hitting it. So he just slammed on the brakes, and, you know, he's probably going 60, 70 miles an hour. And Bruce said he aimed at the back tire of this car, because if he hadn't, they would have probably gone right under the truck.
Gosh.
And been
wow.
decapitated.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And if you'd seen the vehicle, if you'd seen the damages, the whole Cadillac, the whole front end was just pushed right in, right to the driver's seat. You know, you'd swear that nobody could have survived. But Jim Neidhart was in the front seat, and he hit the dashboard, and his nose was just hanging by a piece.
Oof.
You know, and Bruce separated his shoulder, and Mr. Hedo, I think he separated his shoulder from the back seat, and Jerry Morrow's ankle was broken. And after the collision, Bruce got out, and he was like in a state of shock, and another truck came right past them, almost hit Bruce.
Wow.
You know, and Bruce could feel the wind of this truck that went past him, and it smashed right into the truck that Bruce had run into. You know, and this was about minus 35 degree weather in January, so they had to wait about 35 minutes for an ambulance to come from Calgary, and they were hospitalized. But yeah, we had a few major accidents like that, and not surprising when you consider the number of miles they traveled, and always in the cold winter conditions. So yeah.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed, also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Talk is Jericho.
Now, that's another thing about the Calgary promotion that was kind of legendary was the ribs. You'd always hear, like, if you could survive in Calgary with the ribs that were pulled on you with all the different guys. Was it a pretty heavy ribbing territory?
Oh, it was, yeah. Probably not for the guys that were ribbed, that had the
They didn't like it, yeah.
No.
Tell us about some of the ribs. And you don't have to give names if you don't want to. No, if you want to, you can.
Dynamite Kid was perpetrator of a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was always pretty mischievous, but sometimes it would be someone unassuming, some new guy that had maybe come in the territory, but quite a few of them got X-laxed. You know, they would have their coffees or their hot chocolates, and, an X-lax would be put in their cup, and they didn't realize it, and
isn't that a rib on you, though, if you're in the car driving, you had to stop every five?
Yeah. Well, it's this one poor guy, I think Dynamite had done it to some poor guy named Ronnie Lee, who was a guy who had come up from Pittsburgh, and the poor bastard, I think they were driving from Montana back to Calgary, and about every 20 minutes they had to stop on the highway so he could
was the rib on, right?
Shit his guts out in the ditch, they're some pretty good ribs. The Mabel Parties, I think you've heard of them. But
tell us about that.
Well, the Dave Rule, who had been the booker for my dad, and this unfortunately going back a few years, but they would do a Mabel Party about once every 3-4 years. Quite often would be a guy coming into the territory who didn't really know his way around, but the idea was that they were going to set him up with some hot chick named Mabel who would be at some remote cabin. Or acreage, outside of the city, and usually it was someplace in Airdrie, and that was pretty far out of Calgary back then. Airdrie wasn't even a city back then, and Dave Rule would set it up, say, well, the girl's name is Mabel, and it's going to be a blind date. Basically, we're going to bring you to this location where she is, and you can't tell any of the other wrestlers about it. You have to keep it kayfabe, and she's gorgeous, and this description of her being this very hot brunette, and what a voluptuous body, and so they did it with about 3 or 4 wrestlers. Great Antonio was one of them. I think it was Mad Dog Vachon and Dave Rule had organized it, so they brought Antonio to this place outside of Airdrie, and it was just a small cabin. It's like a farmhouse, and they brought Antonio into the living room of the house and said, "Now you wait here, and we'll bring Mabel out to see you." And all of a sudden, there's a shotgun that goes off, and it was Dave Rule's brother Henry, saying, "Mabel, you bitch, and the idea was that he had caught her,
cheating
on him, and all of a sudden you hear the gunshot, and then Dave Rule would come out with blood coming down his chest and say, "He got me, shot me, Antonio, run for your life, before he gets you," Antonio the Great was about 400 pounds, and he's running down this field, and it's pitch dark out, and there's cow shit in the field everywhere, and it's total darkness and running through barbed wire fences, and no cars or anything. You know, there's no, you know, it was probably 20 miles from Highway 2 where they were, and eventually I think he flagged down some RCMP officer and said there's been a shooting. You know, there's been a shooting. I was set up with a date, and I went to this this farmhouse, and I heard a gunshot, and then my friend Dave Rule was shot, and I think he's been left to die, you know, so, but...
stuff like that to pull on the young guys.
Well, yeah, and so they did this with about three or four wrestlers. I know Antonio the Great was one of them, and then John Jardine, who is, later became the Spoiler, they did it with him, and I guess he was so pissed off, so upset. Usually they would find out a week or two after. They'd come into the dressing room the following week, and they'd see Dave Rule there and say, "Dave, what happened to you? I thought you were killed, you were shot, you know." And Dave'd say, "Yeah, he grazed me, you know, but I got out of there and I'm okay." But Don Jardine was so pissed off, and he always held it against the promotion. And I think one guy came up to him, I think in Texas a few years later, and said, "Aren't you the guy that they pulled that Mabel party on?" I guess he hauled off and just clocked his
clocked with the face.
He was so pissed off, you know, so bitter about it. But and I think the last one they did was on some big fat guy that was trying to break in named Mel McWilliams. They used to hang around Abdul the Butcher all the time, and you know, and he was always trying to be kind of a show off and a know it all, and trying to break in the business, but he really didn't want to pay his dues or you know, go to the dungeon to get stretched by Stu. So they fixed Mel up, and I guess when they did it with him, he was running through these fields, and his shoes were off, and he was running, and again, I guess he flagged down an RCMP car and said, and he was completely out of breath, you know, and he said, there's been a shooting, and he said, they shot Dave Rule, you know, and this RCMP officer said, "Well, Dave Rule, the wrestler, you know," and he was a very well-known wrestler, so then I guess they called my dad on the phone and said, "We're investigating a possible shooting here, and do you know anything about it?" And Stu said, "I don't know anything about it, you know, I didn't hear anything," so, but Stu said, "We better cool off in the Mabel parties, because you know, police are kind
the cops know about it."
So,
yeah.
Oh yeah. So, was
Stu still working with guys in the dungeon and stretching them in that time frame, 86, 87?
Oh
was
yeah, it,
really?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Wow.
He, you know, he was still a pretty tough old bastard, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, he had slowed down a little bit, but he was still pretty lethal. He could do a lot of damage. It wasn't until he had torn his quad muscle. And this was doing some kind of appearance at a WCW Starcade where they're honoring all these legend wrestlers. And he had stepped off some platform when they called his name, and it was totally dark. And I guess when he fell, he tore his quad muscle. And after that, you know, he had a lot of trouble walking, and you know, he had a lot of difficulty training guys after that. But right up until you know, the early 90s, you know, he
wow,
was still
okay.
Working out and stretching guys, and you know, and putting in through hell.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, you're talking about, you mentioned, so I'm watching Stampede. I'm going to college because they said, you know, you should get actually Jesse Ventura said, get a college degree before you go into wrestling. And about 6 months before I graduated, I was signed up to go to Hart Brothers Pro Wrestling Camp, and Stampede Wrestling closed. It was probably about February of 80 or February
we
of 90.
Closed, yeah, I think it was about the end of 89 that
yeah.
we closed.
Yeah, and I was going in June of 90. So what was the final decision to make you guys decide that we got to shut this down?
You know, I think there are a few factors. You know, I think the car accident that we had in July of that year.
Oh, the one with Davey and everybody?
With the van, yeah.
Why is that?
I think just the reality, you know, that...
wasn't fun anymore?
No, you know, and rushing to a show because we were late, which was... largely due to wrestlers just deciding they didn't want to work on the show anymore. You know, they didn't want to travel on the trips. I think there was a lot of dissension in the promotion when we brought Dynamite in as the booker, which was around the end of 1988. And I think there's high hopes and expectations that with his drawing power and Davies, because they had just left the WWF, was after the Jacques Rougeau fight with him and that incident, and they came to our promotion. And a lot of high hopes and expectations that they would turn the promotion around, and Stu felt that it was time for a change, you know, and Bruce was kind of pushed to the side, and we brought Dynamite in, and unfortunately it didn't work out. He kind of hot-shotted the territory with a lot of gimmicks, and it's like 1 week we'd have a strap match, a week after it would be like a cage match, and it was overkill, you know, and you know, and the gates just started to drop and drop, and you know, and there just wasn't harmony with a lot of the wrestlers, and then this incident where we punched Bruce in the jaw, basically because some of the wrestlers had instigated or exaggerated something Bruce had said, you know, about Dynamite and Davey, and you know, I'll be honest, there was a lot of roid rage. There was a lot of ribbing that was going on. Guys getting halcyoned and X-laxed. I mean, it was happening almost on a nightly basis, and you know, a lot of the wrestlers didn't even feel comfortable working.
You can see that in the talent too, because you're talking about 86, 87 with Owen, you know, Pillman, Benoit, Muckensing, Karachi Vice, Steve Blackman, Vulcan Singh, all these guys, Rip Rogers, Kerry Brown.
Yeah.
And then as it gets to that 89 stage, it's getting really thin.
Yeah.
I think it was Ricky Starr or something like this or something. I can't
Ricky Rice. Ricky, was in. Yeah. You know,
but then there's like they got. Like, I can't remember the guys' names because they're very forgettable to me. But the guys towards the end of the promotion were not the great performers like you had just a year or two earlier.
No. There are a few other factors. This fellow named Fred May, who was involved with the distribution of my TV show, he was doing a terrible job. His TV production skills were awful. The TV show... had really
downhill.
Suffered, you know, the camera work was lousy, you know, and we were so far behind the WWF in terms of TV production, special effects, and, you know, audiences were demanding more now, you know when you're seeing the high-tech WWE shows with four or five camera angles and, you know, all the special effects and the ring entrances, and we, you know, we just become too...
I think talent too, Ross. So you got to have the talent, right?
We did, yeah. And, you know, and we'd lost a lot of our best talent. Owen had gone to WWF. Pillman had gone to WCW.
The Japanese connection was gone. Yeah. It was just kind of becoming more... It was looking very indie towards the end.
It was, you know, and so you know, and unfortunately bringing Dynamite Davey back, although there was initially... some big gates there, you know, it peaked and it just dropped. And before you knew it, it was just sort of that chain reaction with all our towns, you know, the towns that were steadily drawing once every 2 or 3 weeks, like Red Deer and Medicine Hat, all of a sudden, you know,
they're going down.
They were drawing, and, you know, and it was tough. We were just losing way too much money. And you know, my dad decided that was enough.
Was it Stu's decision?
Yeah.
We're done?
Yeah. And so, you know, it was probably unfortunate for guys like you and Lance Storm and Rick Titan, because if you'd had that opportunity to break in in Calgary, you know, and be working five nights a week, maybe you wouldn't have gotten rich, but I think you would have had the chance to work more regularly as it was, you know. I think you were working at the Victoria Park Community Center.
Actually, before that, it was the Silver Dollar Action Center.
Silver Dollar Action. Were you working Fred May on those shows?
Fred May was CNWA when Stampede closed.
Yeah. I didn't know you worked on those shows.
Yes, he reopened his CNWA, and of course, it's going to be the biggest thing, and you know, that sort of thing. And that was probably around January, February of 91, maybe even November of 90.
Yeah,
but it was. Like, it was kind of in the last.
So you got your start there.
I did, but it was only once a week.
Yeah.
TVs every couple weeks. Bob Brown was booking.
Yeah, that's right.
So it was. You know, some of the talent was the same. You had Johnny Smith was there, and Gama was there.
Duke Myers, Goldie Rogers,
a lot of guys. You know, and then some younger guys like Brett Como, Mike Lazansky.
Yeah.
So there were some guys to work with, but they just didn't have, you know, the desire, the money, the wherewithal. I think, we said earlier, when you come to Calgary, Stampede Wrestling and the Hearts are synonymous with wrestling.
Yeah.
I think it's the reason why, you know, with WWE even, we have a show on Saturday, we're doing the Corral now. It's always a fun show, but it's not like the glory days of the Saddle Dome where you would go on a house show and draw 10,000 people. Hearts and Stampede are synonymous with wrestling in Calgary.
Yeah, absolutely.
And a big hole was left when Stampede closed.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, a big void. So, you know, but it was great that you and Lance did as well as you did, because, you know, I know when you joined the Hart Brothers camp, you know, it was...
There was no Hart Brothers.
No, there weren't, you know. And that
Keith showed up on the first date.
Yeah, you know, I think that was pretty misrepresented, you know. Bruce and Keith had actually run the Hart Brothers camp for about 3 years, and from that group they launched Pillman and Biff Wellington. A couple other guys were pretty decent locals, but didn't go that far, like Jeff Wheeler. I think there was Ken Johnson and mm-hmm. a few others, but some pretty good local guys. Gary Albright, you know, he trained there as well. And then Keith and Bruce kind of had a split, and they went their own separate ways. And you know, Bruce still ran his camp, and he called it Hart Brothers Camp. And then Keith got involved with his Ed Langley, yeah. you know, and he called his Hart Brothers Camp, you know. So, but you know, I think it was very misleading, because when you showed up there, there was no Hart Brothers, mm-hmm. you know. And I think Keith was there for what, one or two
first day
sessions. That to was take about the money, it, you know, and to take the money. Money, and then you know, wasn't around much after yeah. that. So you know, I'm amazed you guys. You learned the trade that well. I mean, I think you obviously had some talent, and you learned from each other.
But even to this day, like, you know, with Lance's school, there's just something about the city of Calgary.
Yeah.
That's, if you're a young wrestler wanting to get into the business, it has a mystique about it. Calgary yeah. is just like, it's a wrestling city. No matter what, from now until the end of time, there's always going to be that magic from Stampede being here and setting the tone yeah. for some 40-odd years, even though it was 25 years ago. It still has that memory, you
yeah.
know?
It really
I
does.
I think it always will.
Yeah. And, you know, Lance is actually... brought some pretty decent guys into the game. You know, some have gone to the WWF.
There's 10 of them, I think, that yeah. are signed in one stage or another.
Yeah, you know, he's a very good teacher, and he's run an excellent school. So you know, there are some opportunities here. Although I wish, you know, there was a promotion that ran even 3-4 times mm-hmm. a week, because it's really hard to advance if you're only wrestling once or twice a month. You know, it's really tough.
Last few questions yeah. for you, Ross. It's a twofold question. Number one, what it doesn't have to be just one. What are your favorite angles around that time frame from 86 to 88 that were really, is there one or two that stand out as like, this one was one of the best?
There are a few. The Jason Zodiac program was excellent, because it got over great for the 5 or 6 months we had them together. Another good one was we were the first ones to ever have like a three-way match, and we called it the Bermuda Triangle. Match. And that it had Hiro Hase, Gamma Singh, and the Viet Cong, and it was the three of them all fighting each other at one time, you know. And now you see three-way matches pretty regularly in WWF, but this was something, or WWE, but this was it was a novel concept back then. You know, never had you seen three guys fighting each other all at one time, and it was like two heels that had turned on each other. It had this split, and one baby face, but the heels were still fighting against each other as well. So, and that was huge, you know, just because it had never
been done before.
Another interesting one, I think we were the first ones to ever have a male versus female. You know, we had Athol Foley fight Wendy Richter, and we called it the Battle of Sexes. I think that was in 83, maybe a little before that time period, but this is before Wendy went to the WWF and had her launch there as the champion. But it was an interesting thing, because Athol Foley was supposedly JR's son, and he's wearing these diaper trunks in the ring.
Was his name Athol?
Athol Foley.
How do you spell it?
A-T-H-O-L.
Athol.
Yeah, okay. So of course everyone would call him asshole, you know, so that's why Bruce gave him the name Athol Foley. But
yeah, if you have a lisp, yeah, he's the Athol.
Yeah, yeah. And he was kind of the wimpy little snivelly crybaby son of JR, and he's probably 170 pounds. And anyway, he was wimping out, I guess, when JR cost Wendy and Joyce Grable a tag team title match. So then she went after John, and Athol tried to come to John's defense, and then she just started pounding on him. So we had a match where they fought each other the week after, and it was interesting, because it was the first time you ever saw a male fight a female. There had been like tag matches, you know, where two girls fought
two
males, you know, and this is long before China and some of the, you know, and
yeah, all the
bigger
revolution,
the
monster,
the heavier women, you know. So Amazing Kong, some of them. But and it was amazing, because she just kicked Athol Foley's ass around the ring everywhere.
Athol Foley,
David Schultz saw the taping of it, and he was so amused by it. He sent it to Hulk Hogan, you know, and I guess Hulk was so impressed with it, he passed it on to Vince, and they decided to bring Wendy in and make her a major baby face, you know, and they kind of launched that angle with her and Cyndi Lauper and I think the Fabulous Moolah.
That's how it all started.
It did, you know, but those were just kind of novel concepts we did.
That had never been seen before.
Yeah, no, you know, and the ladder matches we did, but those dated back to Dan Crawford, who was a very innovative wrestler, and he was working with Toru Kamada, and we just did incredible business with that, you know, so, yeah.
Is there, what's your favorite match that you've seen? Is there one that stands out that you'll always remember?
You know, probably from 1969, the one-hour Broadway with Dory Funk and Billy Robinson, when Dory was world champion, and it was just a classic match, two baby faces going at it. The classic British style against the classic American style. They had never worked with each other before, but, you know, they were both just fantastic workers. You know, Dory was, I think, in his second year as world champion, and it was just amazing. It was nonstop, you know, for 1 hour, you know, just one move after another, backbreakers, suplexes, so many incredible false finishes, you know, and they looked like they could have gone another 20 minutes mm-hmm. at the end. But that certainly stood out to me as, you know, one of the best matches I'd ever seen. It was just a classic babyface match. And then on the other scale, you know, some of the bloodbaths with Archie the Stomper, Goldie, and Abdul the Butcher, and you know, neither one wanted to sell for each other, but, you know, and they'd be brawling outside the ring into the crowd, you know, and the fans were just going nuts because it's like Godzilla fighting King Kong, you know, the two ultimate dominant heels, you know, going at it. And but, you know, it was a brawl, you know, and it was just amazing, like long before ECW and the hardcore matches, you know, and they didn't really like each other, you know, and neither one wanted to sell much for the other, but, you know, but it was incredible heat and mayhem, you know, so you know, it certainly stands out in my memory.
Do people still come up to you and talk about Stampede Wrestling?
All the time.
Yeah,
you know?
I'm sure.
I run into a lot of people and say they miss the old days of Stampede and just the weekly shows they could go to, like every Friday. That was a pastime for so many fans, you know. It was long before we had the Flames and the Hitmen and all the local sports franchises and, you know, all the TV exposure of wrestling. But, you know, a lot of the older fans, you know, who just said that they like to go there every Friday. And that was their big event, you know, sit in the smoke-filled pavilion.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was it, you know, to go there every Friday. And, you know, it was a great event for them. You know, it was, so I run into a lot of those fans and, you know, just people who grew up in the 80s and 90s. And there's not too many of those stars that are left.
Yeah.
I get Brett's retired now and... you know, we've lost a lot of them,
away,
unfortunately.
Yeah,
passed
yeah,
away, but
yeah.
You know, some memories of those stars for sure. So I do run into a lot of fans, and even the some of the wrestlers, we try and get together and have alumni or Hall of Fame inductions for. So Leo Burke, Gamma Singh, the Cuban Assassin, Jerry Moore,
some of them, great performers.
You know, great performers. Yeah. So I try and meet with them once a year, either at a luncheon or a banquet somewhere. You know, it's really nice to see those guys, and Johnny Smith's another one. So
great guy.
You know, a lot of great memories. Yeah.
Well, I appreciate you sharing some of those memories with me, Ross. It was a great time in my life too, being a wrestling fan, watching Stampede, and inspiring me to get into the business. So I appreciate
for sure,
it.
Chris. I'm glad you were inspired, and congratulations to you for how well your career's done and how well your career's gone, and you've been a credit to the industry.
Thank you, Ross. And in the meantime, and in between time, that's it. Another edition of Talk is Jericho. See you next week.
Okay.
Thanks to Ross Hart for sharing all the stories from Stampede Wrestling. It was great to sit down and talk with him. And you know what else is really great? Team Tiger Awesome's take on today's news.
This is the news with Team Tiger Awesome. In Singapore, a business called The Fragment Room offers customers a chance to break stuff with a baseball bat in 30-minute intervals. The stress-relieving activity allows you to smash fragile objects such as teacups, champagne glasses, and your own crumbling sense of self. In teeny tiny baby news, I'd like to have my toys back. Give me my toys back. I'm going to tell Mom if you don't give me my toys back. Wah. And now a check on the hyperbole index. I told you a million times is trading at, like, the highest ever, while the number of greatests of all time continues to climb, even though literally everyone already knew that, making this index the most pointless thing man has ever created. For more sort of, but not really useful news, listen to the Team Tiger Awesome Show every Sunday on the Jericho Network on Podcast One.
So ridiculous, man. Go subscribe to the Team Tiger Awesome Show at Apple Podcasts. Be sure to leave them a 5-star rating and review as well. As a matter of fact, give all the Jericho Network podcasts 5-star ratings and reviews at Apple Podcasts. Killing the Town with Storm and Cyrus. Rock Talk with Mitch LaFon. The Raven Effect. The flagship show, Keeping It 100 with Conan. And, of course, Beyond the Darkness. Get your paranormal fix every weekday with brand new episodes every day, Monday to Friday. And you can get in on their True Crime Tuesdays as well. Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis, the two guys behind Beyond the Darkness, are doing a weekly True Crime Tuesday podcast. You can get that by signing up at patreon.com for just $5 a month. You'll get a new episode every single Tuesday, and the episodes are all commercial free, no commercials. So sign up now at patreon.com. Big thank you to you, and one last big thank you to all the tremendous sponsors of this episode. DDP Yoga, go to ddpyoga.com/Jericho. You're getting 20% off the DDP Yoga Now app and all DDP Yoga related merch. ZipRecruiter, go to ziprecruiter.com/Jericho. Post your job for free. Get the employee that you want. Saks Underwear, 20% off your fat spoutages at saksunderwear.com/Jericho. Once you wear Saks, you'll never go back. Little Caesars, get the extra most bestest pizza for just $6 at participating locations. And a True Car, buy your car quicker, faster, cheaper, easier. Thank you so much for listening. Keep listening for the 60-second AP News headlines coming up next. And next Wednesday, we got the WWE Tag Team Champions of the World. Sheamus and Cesaro are going to be here. And what a conversation that is. A Swiss, an Irish, and a Canadian walk into a hotel in Japan and have an hour-long conversation. You are going to love it. Thank you so much. Have a great weekend in the meantime. And in between time, stay hard, stay hungry. Peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah, boy!
Listen to new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday on the Podcast One app, or subscribe at Apple Podcasts or PodcastOne.com.